Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Jeannie Lee. Today we welcome back Thomas Lockley, Associate Professor at Nihon University in Tokyo, Japan. Tom just published a nonfiction, A Gentleman from Japan, the untold story of an incredible journey from Asia to Queen Elizabeth's court through HarperCollins a bit while ago this year. This story is about a young man and his friends. The young man was known as Christopher, who traveled from Japan to Europe in the late 16th century, which was quite a rare thing to do. Welcome back, Tom. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. It's been a while since you last joined our channel. So just to refresh our listeners' memory, can you briefly tell us about yourself?
Eloquently said, I work for the Nihon University in Tokyo, and I've worked there for 11 years. I mainly research historical stories that I think will be of interest to my students, and therefore they tend to be the more accessible stories, like Yasuke and like this young man, Christopher, who led lives that are almost unbelievably adventurous, but at the same time, hugely tragic as well. So, I'm excited to be able to share this book with you today. It's out on May the 21st, 2024 in North America.
Thank you. Looking forward to it for our listeners, of course. And last time you joined our channel, we talked about Yasuke, the African Samurai, your previous book. So how does this new book depart from the previous one?
The last book was very much in Japan. It was the story of an African man who came to Japan, probably enslaved or indentured in some way, but as a warrior. He was a bodyguard of a Jesuit priest. This one is very much the opposite. It's a story of enslaved Japanese people who are taken to London, and as with Yasuke meeting Nobunaga and entering Nobunaga's service, these two young men, who I focus on the older and the leader of the two, Christopher, go to London. They meet the Queen, Queen Elizabeth I, and then they are fated by London's high society in a similar way that Yasuke was when he was here in Japan. So although it's a Japanese history story, it happens. It is history. It's outside of Japan, which I like to show that Japanese history is international. And that's one of the ways that I'm doing it this time.
Amazing. And this time I want to ask the important question first, because as a historian, I'm very much interested in this question for my own writing as well. So you kind of mentioned this earlier, that this history and story in this book. So in writing this book and in comparison with the book on Yasuke, the African Samurai, I'm curious how you balance between historical writing, nonfiction stories, and presenting historical materials to different audiences who might be reading this book for different purposes.
I try always to be as close to the facts as recorded in sources, historical sources, as I possibly can. In the case of this book, most of the sources were published in Hakluyt, which was the book about English exploration. And the people that wrote them almost as adventures anyway. So I'm literally taking adventure stories from 400 years ago and just editing them into my own words. I mean, the style of their writing is very, very different. And I'm just making it up to date to a modern audience. Which means, although sometimes it feels like fiction and it feels like a non-fact book, actually, as far as possible, everything that is in that book happened. There's a few occasions where we're not quite sure where it happened. We know, for example, that Christopher was interviewed about the Chinese compass and demonstrated this to an English scholar called William Barlow, but we don't know where that happened. I'm going to guess that it happened in London, Everything happened in London and England in those days. But he was a priest in a place called Lichfield, which is it's quite a long way outside of London. So it could feasibly have happened there as well. Anyway, in the book, I conveniently don't even say where it happened. It just happened. And that's the way of getting around those things. So even in that respect, I've tried to keep very, very close to the sources.
Interesting. Later this question will come up probably again because I'm very interested in the kind of sources material you've used. But let's dive into the stories without spoiling too much. So, first of all, how did you come across these stories about Christopher and his friends? And I'm mostly curious, do we know their real names?
I'll start with the names. Sadly, not. But they could feasibly be their real names. If these guys were war orphans, which they might have done, they may well have been taken in by Catholics and given European names from the beginning. They may not have had Japanese names as such. And therefore, it's more likely that their original names, if they weren't Japanese, would have been Portuguese or Spanish, most likely Portuguese. Cristobal. And Cosmos. That's the best we can do. I did try, as we talked about just before this, I tried for years and I could find nothing really. Cosmos, or Cosme, in Portuguese, there was a very renowned priest in Japan called Cosme at this time, and it was likely that that priest baptized our Cosmos, Cosme, or he was given the baptismal name. To name him after this very renowned priest. But beyond that, I'm afraid it's very difficult to say. The other part of the question was, sorry, can I ask you to repeat?
How did you come across these stories about Christopher and his friends?
Well, among historians of Anglo-Japanese, English-Japanese relations, these guys are obviously famous anyway because they're the first time that England and Japan encounter each other anywhere in the world. Just happens not to be in Japan at all. But that shows just how migratory the Japanese people of this age were, whether they wanted to be, in the case of pirates or mariners, or whether they didn't want to be in the case of enslaved people, or something in the middle, because everything points to Christopher himself being a mariner who was probably enslaved and was working at that job as an indentured type of enslaved person. Cosmos, on the other hand, his younger colleague, is documented in a Filipino court case as being the servant of the canon of Manila, the canon being a high priest, a high rank of priest. So we know that he was more of your gentleman's gentleman, if you like, a valet type servant, enslaved servant, probably. Christopher, on the other hand, is a much more hardy man's man. He's documented all over the place as having good knowledge of maritime matters. He's literate. Cosmos is literate as well, but he's literate to the extent that he can translate a map from Chinese into English, for example, which is then published. There's nothing that says Christopher wrote this. It's not got a byline on it. There was nobody else on that ship who could read, conceivably read Chinese. Certainly, no English person at the time was able to read Chinese characters. And therefore, we have to conclude that Christopher and/or Cosmos, or both of them, but probably Christopher, given his maritime knowledge, which is documented elsewhere, was the translator of that map.
Interesting. And could you tell us something about the historical background of this story? Because from reading it, I get that Christopher and his friends, when they went to England, they stopped at many other places as well. So I guess what was the relationship between Japan and the so-called Western world? And what was traveling like for ordinary Japanese people like at the time?
Well, the English were essentially pirates, privateers, and they took a Spanish ship called the Santa Ana just off what is now California. This is where Christopher and Cosmos, and three Filipino colleagues of theirs who were on the ship, are taken from the Spanish ship and put onto the English ship. It is quite a long way from California to London today, but in those days it took a year, and that was a fast voyage. So it's almost exactly a year between the time they leave California and the time they arrive in Plymouth, and then a few weeks later, after customs have cleared and things, they arrive in London. It's almost a year to the day. Travel was hard and very, very dangerous. One of the reasons that Cavendish was looking to fill his ship with anybody was because half of his crew had already died getting between London and California. There had been 120 people on it originally, which was overloaded. A ship like that shouldn't really have more than 50 or 60 people on it, but they doubled up as a kind of insurance policy. The more people you have, even if half of them die, you've still got enough to sail the ship home. I know it's excruciating, isn't it? But that's what happened. And the way they were paid was in loot, in booty, in plunder. So, I mean, these are pirates after all. Even if they're given a veneer of legality by having a letter from the Queen saying they can be pirates, they are still out there killing, plundering, stealing, and doing all sorts of nasty stuff. Christopher and his colleague Cosmas and the three Filipino lads were not necessarily taken as sailors to replace the dead English sailors. They were taken for their intelligence, for their knowledge of what was coming. No English ship had ever been in these waters around the Philippines, potentially China and Japan, Taiwan. No English ship had been anywhere close to this before, and they had no idea what was coming. They had maybe rumors, and that was it. So he also took a Portuguese pilot, a Spanish pilot as well, who knew the route to the Philippines, and he took an African man who, slightly puzzling, but the records say spoke the Morisco tongue, which I presume must mean Arabic. And this person would be used as an interpreter. He's unnamed, unfortunately, to be used as an interpreter when they get to Islamic lands in what is now Indonesia, for example. So travel was hard. Many of them died. And to be honest with you, I would not have been a traveler in those days, even if it gave me a chance at getting rich quick. It would have been safer to stay at home and die poor.
So Christopher, this brave Christopher and his friends, what did they do exactly? Without spoiling too many from the stories, how did they end up being on that ship? And throughout their journey, where did they stop at? How did they perceive, if we have any sources about that, how did they perceive what they saw at the time that was probably not accessible for a lot of their fellow Japanese at the time?
We know that they were on this ship, the Santa Ana, and we know that that ship left the Philippines, Manila, Cavite, the port of Manila, earlier on in that year of 1587. So they had to have been in the Philippines. It didn't stop between there and California, and therefore we can trace them back that far. To go further than that is very hard. We have to go into the types of Japanese people who were outside Japan in those days. The vast majority of them were enslaved people. I would say at least 90%, possibly nearer to 100%, were enslaved people. Either had been transported on Japanese ships to be sold, Chinese ships to be sold, or in this case, probably because we're talking about Manila here, Portuguese ship via Macau, maybe. No Spanish ship by this point had reached Japan on purpose. Anyway, there was one wreck a few years before, but there was no real contact between Manila, Spanish Manila, and the Japanese islands besides piracy at this point. So tracing them back further to that, we're into the world of hypothetic history and looking at chances. As with Yasuke in African Samurai, I went back to Africa and looked at where the Africans that came to India and Asia had mainly come from and started my conclusions from there. The second part of the question, how did they perceive it? We have no testament from any of these lads, unfortunately. All of them are All of them are sources in English, French, Spanish, possibly Dutch later on as well, but that would have been translated from the English. We know specifically that they could write, and there is a record of them writing in London. It's the first time an Asian language is recorded as being written in London. But we don't frustratingly have that writing, or if it is somewhere, it's nobody's identified what it signifies, if you like. So we have no testimony from them, I'm afraid.
Unfortunately, yeah. As you probably know, I'm all about sources, primary sources myself. So I was really hoping that there was some kind of magical material that you didn't include in the book that could give us some sense about what happened after they
Well,
get
the
to
nearest we could, sorry, after get to
after they got to
the
Europe
nearest we can
and yeah.
the nearest we can get is diary entries by Christopher's friend, who is a man called Anthony Knivet, who specifically says him and Christopher were best of friends. And then he goes on to describe Christopher in detail, and then describes their bust up, which over money, they're human, right? And they have a bust up over money. And then their friendship is forever finished. And that's the last we hear of Christopher, unfortunately. And we also have some specific testimony from people in London, including Hakluyt himself, the great chronicler himself, who says something about how wonderful it is that these people from Japan are speaking English in our rainy climate. And so we have a feeling that they were walking around a rainy London, and they were definitely speaking English. They had a very good level of English. And one thing that comes out in almost every single source is their intelligence and their literacy, which is highly unusual in Europe at this time, as it was in Japan too, but it was probably more unusual in Europe. So they had a sense of wonder about them. The people that saw them had a sense of wonder about these visitors from the East, these amazing people.
That's very interesting. So, according to the English sources, sources written in England at the time, as well as European materials, documentations, how did these European people see this perhaps one of the first groups of Japanese people to have arrived in Europe? What were some of the impressions that they described in the documentation?
Well, as I said previously, they were just almost always they're described as literate and intelligent. They're actually described as naturalists, which is what we would now term a scientist or a scholar. So their status within society, initially they were gentlemen, i.e. nobles. But when it was discovered that they were not that, they were given a new title of respect. To be called naturalists. And that's how the English saw them. And of course, the other people in England that saw them, there is a Dutchman who wrote a letter about them, for example, also saw them in this light. These guys had information which nobody else in England could possibly have access to. And therefore, they were extremely in demand.
Fascinating. What kind of information would they not have access to?
Well, the Dutchman's record, he actually writes in French, but he was originally a Dutchman. He's writing about herbology. So they have some herbs, and they don't really know what these are or what to do with them. It turns out it's star anise or bajiao in Chinese, right? But they don't know what this is. They know they can smell it, and they can smell that it's got a kind of aniseed flavor, but they don't know what to do with it. Is it a medicine or what? So they consult Christopher and a colleague, one of the Filipino colleagues, about this, for example. There's also other ones as well, but those other herbs were from the Americas, and it's unlikely that Christopher would have had knowledge of those particular things. But I think much more likely that this was something that they were being consulted on almost every day or every week during the 2 or 3 years they were around. And we just don't have the records left for most of them. It's amazing that so many of these letters and diaries and little bits in books here and there have even come to light at all. I would really love to find more, but I couldn't go any further in this case. I'm sure some will come.
I was very curious how you collected these materials because it sounds like they were written a long time ago and they were scattered around, and in different languages too. So how did you go about collecting these materials?
Well, the first ones, the ones in like Hakluyt, the books, they're quite well known. I mean, these are some of the best sellers in English language over the centuries. So it's not that difficult to find those. And other people, friends, knew of these and I knew of these. So they're kind of in the public domain really. Others I came across just little by little. Oh, they came out. Oh, another source. I can't describe how they just happened. And I think it was destiny. So I was reading a paper about compasses, for example, and suddenly the mention of these two lads being consulted for compass technology, which is very, very weak in Europe at the time. They had no liquid compasses; they're all dry compasses, for example. And so these two lads, Christopher in particular, demonstrates the use of a liquid compass with water in it. It doesn't work so well because it would have frozen over in most European waters or all the waters that those English ships were going to go to. And it took another 200 years for the Europeans to work out you put alcohol in it, you put liquid industrial alcohol in it, and the freezing point goes down, and therefore you can have a liquid compass. But that kind of compass was not in use in Europe until the 19th century. So the Chinese compass, which had been used for hundreds of years, even before Christopher, was way ahead of its time in the European context. And therefore, this knowledge exchange from East to West, which therefore goes to help build the West later on, it's happening there in front of your eyes in this book. We hear about gunpowder and paper somehow getting from China to Europe at some point over hundreds of years. We don't know how or where those actually entered Europe from China or who did it. In this case, we can see that action actually in a recorded book. We know who the person was, Christopher, and we know who he was talking to, William Butler. And that is what I think is crucial about this book.
And you've mentioned these, so they brought technology of compasses, and Christopher drew maps, and they were consulted on herbal science. I'm curious if you could speak more to, apologies, my dog's screaming in the background. If you could speak more about the colonialist and historical the trading landscape of the time. What kind of, because it sounded like their European friends were very interested in these technology and the science that they were able to bring. So how was that like? What kind of technology was being introduced into Europe, and how about vice versa?
That's a good question. Besides the compass, we know that the map making technology, which is not technology as such, it's just knowledge of what the coasts and waters of East Asia looked like. We know that that map was translated from Chinese into English, and we can say with almost 100% certainty that Christopher did it because nobody else could have possibly have read the Chinese at the time. That map also had population details, taxation details, military details of China, in specifically of China, on it as well. So you're getting far more knowledge of these there. As to other technology, there's no direct technology that we can talk about. But again, all of the sources talk about. There are matters of many interest in maritime technology. They don't specifically say which technology it is, but they're all hinting at the fact that things have been passed over, and that Christopher, in particular, as opposed to all of his colleagues, is the one that's doing this. So I wish I could be more specific, but sadly I can't in this situation. There's one other very interesting point. The first globe was made in England at this time, the first English globe. Of course, the midden globes made it all over the place before this 500 of years, but the first English globe was made at exactly the same time that that Christopher was in London. It was made by a man called Molyneux, Emrys Molyneux. And there's some evidence to say that they were on that ship for a year. Molyneux was also on the same ship for a year from California to London. And therefore, what conversations did they have that helped Molyneux make his globe? We don't know. But we can, I would say that if Molyneux was making maps and globes, which was his profession, and he's got an Asian mariner who's clever with maps and can read and write, he's got to have talked to him. They're within 10 meters of each other for a year, pretty much. They're probably sleeping in the same room. What unrecorded intelligence went between them or went between other scholars and Christopher? The boundaries are pretty much endless.
Interesting.
The possible.
I'm also curious about your book. There were many small stories collected in here. Was there any documentation of the original cultural shock, either from I guess we don't really have documentation from the Japan side, but from the Western viewpoint, what were some of the cultural shocks that they may have seen from Christopher and his friends?
Well, the primary one is that they could speak English. That was a shocking, shocking thing. Foreigners didn't speak English in those days. English was an almost dirty language, only spoken there. The international language within Europe would have been French. It's why many of the documents pertaining to Christopher are in French, is because that was the international language. Latin or perhaps Spanish. Pretty much English was a creole spoken only among certain people. Even many people in what is now England didn't speak English. They spoke other languages, Welsh, Manx, Cornish, and in the north they had a whole different dialect of English, which is almost incomprehensible to the people in the south. So the first thing that the Londoners notice is that these guys can speak English, and that to them is flabbergasting, which I think is really sweet, because today, of course, English is the international language, and it's a very important language. We're talking in English right now, but in those days, that was the first thing. The cultural shock was the English language was being spoken by a foreigner. There aren't many other particular cultural things mentioned, so I can't go much further than that. Yeah, I suspect that they'd been so acclimatized over a year on the ship that they probably didn't seem that foreign to anybody, not that foreign anyway, by that point. And then they were dressed in English clothes, they would have had English haircuts, or not English haircuts, because probably the hairs hadn't been cut for a year. they probably smelt like English people, which wouldn't have been very particularly nice smell at the time, probably, et cetera, et cetera.
Since we still have plenty of time left, I want to invite you to share one of your favorite stories from their adventure. Is there a particular episode that you really enjoyed writing about?
I'm not going to use the word enjoy. I'm going to use the word that affected me, because it's tragic. It's a tragic episode. When they're trying to get back to Japan on their voyage, which is supposedly setting out for Japan, and they have to go around South America to get there, and they have to go through the Strait of Magellan to get there. The ship tries time and time and time and time again to get through these rough straits. In fact, behind me, the background of my Zoom right now is that particular point where they're trying to get through these stormy seas. But they've gone in the wrong season, because the planning was awful. They've run out of food. they've run out of supplies, the sails are all shattered, and the masts are falling over, et cetera, et cetera. And they try again and again for months on end, but they can't make it. In the end, the sailors mutiny and force the commander, Thomas Cavendish, to head back into the Atlantic. It must have been so heartbreaking for everybody concerned, not just Christopher and his colleagues, but for everybody concerned, because that was the end of their mission. If they couldn't get through the Strait of Magellan, there was no possible way for them to get to Japan. They could have gone the other way around Africa, but by that point, the ships were in such a bad condition, they could hardly even move at all, let alone go all the way around the world the other way to get to the place where they wanted to do. So that heartbreaking feel is something I thought about a lot. In the end, I don't think it's a spoiler. Almost everybody dies, including Christopher and Cosmas. And unfortunately, we don't know when or where that happened. That's discussed in the book, of course.
Yeah, that is indeed a tragic. And I wish we had more materials left about these people to tell a more detailed story. But moving forward, if you get a chance to expand this study and to collect more materials, more information about them, what kind of information would you like to see to make the life stories of Christopher and his friends more complete?
I'd like to know where they came from. I suspect it was Kyushu, because that's where almost all of the slaves came from. But I don't know. There is an intriguing detail from William Barlow, the compass maker, that Christopher was from Miyako, from Kyoto. But I think that's just him trying to boost Christopher's status, because I cannot see how somebody from the imperial capital, and there was no shogun at the time, but basically the capital city of the country, would have been enslaved in that way and sent overseas. It's highly unlikely. So I'd love to know the truth of that. If it really did come from Miyako, then what the hell was he doing in Manila? Why was he there? There's also, where did they die? I mean, if we could pinpoint that, then a memorial could be erected to them or something. I'd love to know, have somewhere connected specifically with these men, that they can be remembered with connection to land or sea, it doesn't matter. That would be something I would be looking for. I have to say, I have to give credit to other people. When I say that I found these sources, I did find some, but often people would say, "Oh, Tom, I found this source here. This will help to your story. We know you're working on this. Here you go." So these are not all, I don't want to give the impression that I went and read every single book about Elizabethan England to find the random stories, although I tried. but other people also contributed to this. It's about 8 years since I started now. So there's been quite a lot of time and backwards and forwards. And of course, I helped other people with their research as well. And they helped me. That's how research works. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about being in academia, especially in history, is people sharing and talking together to make the research better and to make our lives better.
Thank you. That's very well said. And I'm glad we could end on such a positive looking note. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure, and good luck with everything.
Thank you. That was Thomas Lockley and his new book, A Gentleman from Japan, the untold story of an incredible journey from Asia to Queen Elizabeth's court. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. You can find out more about this book on our website. It is currently available in ebook, paperback, and audiobook. This is Jin Yi Lee. Stay tuned for our next episode.